From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk with historian and professor of law Mary Sarah Bilder. Her newest book reexamines the copious notes the founding father James Madison took during the 1787 Constitutional Convention.
One of the great goals of history is to try and get back in a space where everybody doesn't yet know the future. And so the notes were sort of this opportunity. The problem with the notes is that they were revised by Madison over his lifetime.
Then longtime Milwaukee Rep artistic director Joe Hanretty returns to town to direct a play at Next Act Theater. He says that even though everyone wants to know if it's strange to be back at a different theater, it really isn't.
We're a tribe that finds our bond wherever we go, I think.
Plus, we'll have the latest episodes of Radio Chipstone and our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. First, the news. Good afternoon, this is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The Constitutional Convention of 1787 is one of the most important events in the history of the United States. After 4 months of painstaking deliberation, the Founding Fathers emerged with a document that continues to inform how we interpret the laws of the land. But the convention was not open to the public, so much of our interpretation on what happened there is based on accounts from the Founding Fathers, most notably James Madison.
His notes are considered a top treasure of the American people in the Library of Congress and are the most complete record of what happened at the Constitutional Convention. As a result, they've become the main source of information on what happened that hot summer in Philadelphia.
But the notes were revised many times over Madison's lifetime, presenting a different picture of the convention than he did in his original writings. These revisions and their implications are at the heart of Mary Sarah Bilder's latest book, Madison's Hands, Revising the Constitutional Convention. Bilder spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and explained why Madison's notes have become so important.
There was an official record taker, that is a person who kept the official journal, and that was just the motions that had been brought. And we often think that legislative procedures and the convention would operate the way we think about legislative procedures, so we have access to what people say. But at the time the Constitution was written, people didn't believe that the public should necessarily have access to the deliberations. In fact, when Congress opened its doors, the House decided that the public could hear what people said, and they built galleries. But the Senate actually remained closed into the 1790s, and then under public pressure decided people had to be able to listen. So Madison took his notes, like other delegates, for himself, and I argue also for Thomas Jefferson. And the notes have historically been read as if they were taken by a stenographer. We call them notes, but they really haven't been treated that way. We think they were kept sometimes by a third-party person, but they were actually kept by a person who was incredibly involved. And what my book tries to do is think about how do we read those notes differently if we understand they're something more along the lines of a diary of someone who was interested in participating in the debates.
When we're thinking about the Constitution and we're thinking about the setting, who is James Madison? What is he to that creation of the Constitution?
Yeah, well, after the Revolution in 1776, the Congress that wrote the Declaration of Independence created a committee to write what they called a constitution, a document that would help set up the governing structure. And we call that the Articles of Confederation. And that first constitution governed the country in the 1770s and 1780s. And then in the 1780s, it became increasingly evident to people like George Washington and a number of other leaders that that didn't work any longer, that the articles weren't useful for the kind of nation the United States wanted to be. For example, there was only one branch of government, and it was Congress. There wasn't a president, there wasn't a judiciary, and it was very difficult to accomplish anything in that Congress. So a number of people decided that there should be a new convention to try and alter the document so that the United States would be strong enough to resist invasion and had the power to fund an army and issues like that. And so they decided to have a convention in Philadelphia in 1787, and there were delegates elected from their states to participate. And James Madison was chosen by the Virginia legislature to attend.
We now think of him, and he is in fact often called the father of the Constitution, a moniker which you disagree with. But he's also, in this way, a representative, really, of the interests of Virginia, which were distinctly different than the rest of the colonies.
Right. He gets called the father of the Constitution towards the end of his life. In part, that's the product of the fact that he outlives everybody. He is the last of the framers to be alive. And the older he got, the more that people would come and ask him about what it was like in the early stages. And because everybody thought he had pretty good notes, but also because he had written the Federalist Papers with Alexander Hamilton, he seemed to be a great sage of the Constitution. And I think he's incredibly important in the convention. He loved politics. He participates. He left us a remarkable record. But I think it's important to realize that the Constitution was the product of a group of people. It wasn't just one person writing that document.
When we think about the notes now, a lot of what has become sort of intermingled and a lot of what you really look at are the revisions. So what is the timeline on those notes, and how do those revisions change our perception of the Constitutional Convention?
What I did when I wrote the book was I tried to think about what did these notes look like as Madison wrote them. That is, what was it like to be him that summer? And to be trying to accomplish a certain type of government. It's not the government that we actually have today. And what do the notes tell us about that process? That is, I was very interested in using the notes to sort of bring back to life what it was like that summer. One of the things that is really hard for historians, but very important, is we know what happens in history, but the people at the time don't know what happens. So one of the great goals of history is to try and get back in a space where everybody doesn't yet know the future. And so the notes were sort of this opportunity. The problem with the notes is that they were revised by Madison over his lifetime. And he said this, and it was known when they were published. But people have largely sort of ignored the revisions. I tried to use those revisions to basically unwind the manuscript back to this moment in the summer of 1787. And when you go back and try and sort out what parts of the manuscript date from that summer as he's writing, you begin to have a sense of a very different type of situation. One example of that is that he had lots of little comments at the time that are the kinds of comments we would all write if we were keeping a diary, largely for ourselves and a friend, but then later on don't sound maybe so dignified. For example, there's a Maryland delegate, Luther Martin, who tended to give extremely long speeches. And at the end of Madison's relatively short record of that speech, with which he did not agree, he wrote along the lines, "This is the substance of a very long speech." And you can see in that moment, you know, he's sort of sitting there, he's exhausted, he doesn't agree with the speech, it's going on, and he writes that. Well, later on, he decided that that wasn't sort of the tone he wanted to have. And so he crossed that comment out. And there are similar characterizations of people who he disagreed with that are more spontaneous, that sort of get you back in that moment where they were really arguing about things. And then later on, again, he altered a lot of those words to make it feel much more moderate and objective. It was really fun because sometimes the convention feels, I think, almost a little bit boring to people because it does have this, through Madison's notes, moderate, quiet tone. But when you get back to what he wrote in the original version, you can sort of hear a little bit more of the frustration and disagreements and excitement of being there that summer.
When we think about the setting in which the Constitution was crafted, a summer in which many of these men were away from their families, you know, arguing day after day with one another about really trying to keep up this fledgling nation, I think it kind of informs the way that we look at it now. And one of the big things that you press, and you just had an op-ed about this in the Boston Globe, that the Constitution at the time was not written for forever. People at the time did not think like this was the Constitution, something reflected in Madison's notes. How did the revision sort of address the change in perception of the Constitution?
I think one of the most important things that we owe the framers is just enormous respect for their efforts in a moment when they really feared the country was going to fall apart. They were worried that the European powers would think the United States was weak and invade. There was constant anxiety about the idea that the United States might split into three sections. They were worried about a single strong person coming along and taking over sort of what they would imagine as a monarch. And so they were really working incredibly hard to design a structure of government that summer. And there were lots of things they disagreed on. And by the end, they were completely exhausted. I think they did want the Constitution to endure. They wanted it to stay into the future and stabilize the country. But I don't think they would have ever imagined that summer that we would parse it the way we do. We read it sometimes as if every single comma was given great thought. They honestly didn't even have the luxury to do that. They were trying to save the nation. And I really think, regardless of one's political beliefs, it's so important to appreciate that, the stress under which they wrote that document. So one of the things that the revisions show us is that a lot of what we see when we look at the Constitution is the product of 200 years of people living under that Constitution. They just didn't imagine it yet that way. The concept of the Constitution is changing because we're the very first country to have a written Constitution. And we're the very first country to think that you could have a written Constitution and a separate judiciary, and the judiciary would interpret it. So it's all kind of a great invention, but it's an invention where not everything's been completely thought out. And I think that's a wonderfully exciting space to be in. But it does mean that there's a lot of questions that we have to figure out more for ourselves.
Well, and your op-ed gets into this. The Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch has been referred to as an originalist. Former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was also sort of considered an originalist. First, for those who may not know, what is an originalist? And what do you find flawed about this interpretation of the Constitution?
Neil Gorsuch's confirmation hearings raised a lot of issues about what did it mean to be an originalist? What was this label that people were throwing around? And I honestly think there's a lot of different understandings of that term. There's a way that maybe the general public understands it, and then there's a way that legal scholars who have spent a lot of time writing about it understand it. The way that legal scholars who spend time writing about originalism would say is they believe that you can find in the text an original public meaning, and that what a judge should do is simply take any modern case, apply that original public meaning to it, and decide the case. Personally, I do not believe that that original public meaning is findable in any way that decides cases that are really hard. I think more importantly that for a long time, judges across the political spectrum decided these cases by using types of interpretation that combined understanding the historic origins and context, understanding how the Constitution had been altered, understanding how we would live under the Constitution, and that originalism suggests that the Constitution is a type of document that was literally beyond the capacity of the people in 1787. A lot of conservative justices have not been originalists, and it's only since the 1980s that there's been a sense that conservative justices should follow this type of judicial philosophy.
And this gets back to, of course, the creation of the Constitution, and sort of seems to at least imply that all the founding fathers were like, yes, this is the Constitution. Great. We've done a wonderful job, guys. But even James Madison didn't seem entirely happy with the way the Constitution came out.
No, James Madison was very upset even at the end of the convention. He wrote a great letter to Thomas Jefferson before the convention ended. Thomas Jefferson's in France at the time, and he really worried about the Constitution. Madison had not wanted the states to be represented directly in Congress. And Madison also worried enormously that the legislatures, that state legislatures wouldn't be sufficiently controlled. He had wanted an idea that we find incomprehensible. He wanted the government to have something called a negative, which was a veto power. And he thought Congress should actually be able to veto state legislation. That's incomprehensible to us in our modern system. So in September, he was really not very happy. He then defended the Constitution in all sorts of interesting ways in the Federalist Papers that he wrote with Hamilton. And then in 1789, he introduced amendments to the Constitution. He had made a campaign promise that he would add a Bill of Rights, and so he actually worked very hard to fulfill that campaign promise. When the amendments go through the House and Senate, they don't look a lot like what Madison thought, but they do alter the Constitution. Madison wanted the amendments to be interwoven. He actually thought the amendments should literally revise the Constitution. Instead, Congress decided that amendments would be supplemental to the Constitution. That is, we would tack them on to the end. And this is a great example of how people really haven't quite figured out what a Constitution is going to be. I mean, we think it would be very strange to revise it, although some state constitutions are written that way now.
Well, and we're right now in Wisconsin looking at a push for a constitutional convention, an Article 5 convention, which would give people the ability to literally sit down and revise this document from 1787 that has really persisted for more than 200 years. When we're talking about an Article 5 convention, how does that really play out? Do we know?
The Constitution has two modes that you can change it. Change the actual words. One mode is that Congress can put forward an amendment, and then that amendment is sent out to the states, and then the states have to ratify it. And that's the mode that's been used since the beginning of our country under the Constitution, and it's the mode under which every single one of our amendments has been added. There's a second method that Article 5 says would be legal. It's the method that reflects the origins of the convention itself. It says that the states can call Congress to have a new convention. And so this would be a new convention. And then again, anything that they wrote would have to be ratified by state legislatures or conventions. And right now, it's that second method that some people think would be a good idea. That is, that we should have a new convention to rewrite the Constitution. Some people argue that that convention could be limited to a single issue. Some of the bills, and this may be the bill in Wisconsin, try to limit it just to a balanced budget amendment. But the Constitution doesn't provide for that. In fact, the Constitution uses the word amendments. There's no constitutional means to limit a convention once it begins to a specific agenda. So if you call a convention, you can't control the agenda. This is why the convention method has never been used. Everybody early on realized that if you call a convention for even one purpose, once the delegates get together, they can do all sorts of things. They'll basically end up rewriting the Constitution. So it's a very radical approach to amending the Constitution.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for joining me and speaking with us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks so much, Joy, for having me.
Mary Sarah Bilder is the Founders Professor of Law at Boston College Law School. She's the author of Madison's Hands, Revising the Constitutional Convention. She was in Milwaukee earlier this week to deliver the first annual McGaffey Lecture for the Department of History at UWM. Bilder spoke with Joy Powers.
Next Act Theater opened the play Bloomsday this past week. We'll catch up with the show's director, Joe Hanready, when Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Joe Hanretty is a familiar name to theater audiences in Milwaukee. He was the artistic director at the Milwaukee Rep from 1993 to 2010. During that tenure, the company created and staged more than 50 new American plays, in addition to classics from Shakespeare to Tennessee Williams.
Since he left the Rep, Hanretty has continued staging new work as well as his own adaptations of literary classics. He's created new work for theaters across the country, and his schedule shows no signs of slowing down. What he hasn't done is return to Milwaukee to direct. Until now.
Next Act Theater's new production of Bloomsday opened on Friday, starring Kerry Hitchcock and Norman Moses, and is directed by our next guest, Joe Hanretty. Hanretty says the show is a fork-in-the-road play, one where the characters look back at a pivotal moment in their lives and realize that it changed their lives forever.
Hanretty joined me in the studio earlier this week. Joe, welcome back to the show. We were trying to figure out before we turned on the mics. It has been years since we talked.
I know. We pass in the lobbies for shows every once in a while, but it's great
kind
to sit down.
And say hello. So, my goodness, what have you been doing since you left the Rep? Lots of writing, lots of directing?
Yeah, I've been well-traveled, I would say. A lot of the Shakespeare festivals, I've been doing classical work at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, the Idaho Shakespeare Festival, the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival, and writing adaptations of plays. I'll be writing one for the Utah Shakespeare Festival that I'll start rehearsing in August.
Well, you are actually doing something much closer to home, like right this week, though, for Next Act Theater. This is the first time you've directed since you left the Rep.
It is in town. Yes, yeah. Yes. I've done a couple of student projects at UWM, but I left the Rep in 2010, and we still have a home here, although we live mostly in Door County. But this is the first time I've been able to work for one of our colleague theaters. When I was at the Rep, I saw almost all of the plays that I could at the Next Act and Chamber Theater and all of the colleague theaters. But this is the first chance I've had to actually direct. It's been a wonderful experience.
So you're doing a play by a playwright whose work I really like, Stephen Dietz, and he's very prolific. There are a lot of plays of his that are produced in regional theaters and smaller theaters around the country. Lonely Planet is probably the one, and that's the one I'm most familiar with because a theater company I was associated with years ago did a production of it, and I sort of fell in love with his writing. Mm-hmm. And so what was it about this particular play that drew you? Was it the writing? Was it the way he sets things up?
This is a relationship play, and there are two characters played by four actors. And I think what drew me to it was the writing. Stephen writes delicious dialogue. It is just full of wit and clarity, and actors just love to speak his lines. It's about something that I think almost anybody that can relate to. I think it's a fork-in-the-road play where one looks back and looks at a pivotal moment in their life that they think just a moment's hesitation or something that they reacted to wound up setting their life on an entirely different course. And in this case, it's a love relationship and a conversation that kind of went awry for a moment, and the relationship never recovered from it, and someone is going back in time 35 years later to explore what might have happened, to maybe meet up with that partner from years before. And it's a reflective play. But what Stephen has done is he writes very perceptively about relationships, but he's a very theatrical writer. He's a very clever writer. And he plays with time in this play. And it's inspired in some ways by James Joyce's Ulysses. That's why it's called Bloomsday.
Yes.
And the setup for the play is that a young man takes a trip to Dublin, and he winds up stumbling into a Bloomsday tour of all of the sites that Leopold Bloom visited on his one-day walk through Dublin. And it's a very attractive and charismatic tour guide that he has an infatuation with. He doesn't know anything about James Joyce or Bloomsday, but he comes inspired by that to become a Joyce professor. And this is the revisit and the rekindling, he hopes, of that relationship.
35 years later.
35 years later.
You know, it's one of those things where it's that moment in time where you don't even realize things have shifted until you look back 30 years later and you go, wow, that was the moment when my life went in a direction that I – usually they're not that clear when you're in the middle of it.
And it takes a very evolved person not to look back and say, what if, and to kind of let that spin in your mind. Whether or not you're filled with regret, remorse, guilt, it can't help but have an effect on the relationships that you have subsequently to that. And that, I think, is largely what the play is about.
How much does the work of Joyce play into it? Do we hear any of his wonderful sentence constructions?
Very little. It is mercifully comprehensible, the play is, as opposed to being as dense and stream of conscious as Joyce's work. So in fact, that the difficulty of James Joyce's Ulysses is sent up in the play, I think, quite a bit by the professor who's grown disenchanted with the book after teaching it for so many years. But I have to tell you, you don't need to know anything about James Joyce or Ulysses to enjoy the play.
Yeah, he was one of those authors that obviously changed, you know, the way books were written. But I have to confess, I'm one of those people that I've never made it through Ulysses. I've tried over the years. I've given up at this point. But the one thing that I do get from the bit of Ulysses that I've read is just sort of the beauty of that part of Ireland. You know, we think of Dublin as the city, but there's all of this in the bay. There's so much interesting and beautiful country that sort of evoked in that. And is this something that comes out in the play? Is there sort of a love affair with Ireland, too?
There's a love affair of the character of Molly Bloom. And the most famous chapter in the book is the eighth chapter and the last chapter, which is about 40 or 50 pages, but it's only eight sentences. And this is Molly Bloom's imagining and dreaming of her lover who is going to visit her while her husband, Leopold Bloom, is out doing errands for the day. And it's full of desire and longing, and it is frank and candor-filled monologue. And many people have read Molly Bloom's chapter more than the book itself. And I think that's really more the literary inspiration in the center for the play.
Is working here in this different stage, in this different capacity, how does that feel for you, having been at the Rep for so many years?
Well, I've known the two actors in the lead, Norman Moses and Carrie Hitchcock, since the time I moved to Milwaukee in the early 90s. And so it's certainly wonderful to get a chance to work with them. I've known David for almost all of that time period as well. So, and I've seen so many of the plays there that I really do feel quite at home. And I enjoy it. You know, people ask me if it feels strange. You know, no. I mean, you're in a rehearsal hall with actors every day and with a very talented support team around you. And it's very much the same wherever you go. You form a wonderful close connection with the people in the room, and you work and become very close with each other, and you share a sense of humor. And we're a tribe that finds our bond wherever we go, I think.
I think so, too. You also have a really great new space. Well, it's not so new anymore, but, I mean, new since Next Act began, you know, that wonderful space down on in the Fifth Ward.
It's really perfect for the play. And our design team, you know, headed by Rick Rasmussen, who's done the set, have just done a terrific job. I'm really pleased with the physical production as well.
So you'll come back?
Yes, absolutely, if I'm asked.
Yes. Well, Joe Hanratty, it has been so great catching up with you. It's so nice to see that some of your work is going to be in town again. It's been a long time since we've got to see your work here.
Yeah.
And so we're pleased with that. And best of
luck. I'll be at the Milwaukee Rep again in the fall.
Oh, good. Yes. Well, that's wonderful. Yes, I think I remember seeing that in the announcement. So that's great as well. Best of luck with the adaptation this summer.
Thank you so much.
And I hopefully will talk with you in the fall when you're back at the Rep.
Thanks, buddy.
Joe Hanratty directed Next Act Theater's current production of Bloomsday. It opened earlier this week and runs through the end of the month. There is more information at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we'll have the latest episode of Radio Chipstone, so stick around. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Have you been tinkering away on an invention you hope will be the next big thing? Or maybe you've already built a better mousetrap but don't know how to get it to market. If you're connected with UW Madison, you might want to talk with John Biondi.
Biondi is the director of discovery to product at UW Madison, and he's the guy charged with helping people take their inventions from the lab to the marketplace.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Biondi talks with contributor Jennifer Fields about the steps that take an idea from being theoretical to being available at your neighborhood store.
We take innovations that arise from campus here, whether that's from faculty labs or dorm rooms. And once they're kind of at the invention stage, we work with them to try to take them out to the market, to try to figure out what we need to do in order to commercialize these innovations, whether that's to make a startup company out of them, which is what we primarily do here, or to help license them to other outside companies.
Is that a typical model? Is that the way things usually work, or is this a different twist on that?
The model as to what we do at Discovery to Product, or D2P, is moderately new within universities. These innovations, when they first come out of the lab, the total focus on those innovations has been from the science side, is how we develop these things and what they are from a scientific or an idea standpoint. And frequently, how that innovation might show up in the marketplace might be somewhat different, if not noticeably different, than what the innovator might think of while they were working on this thing from a science standpoint. So that collision, if you will, of the innovation with the customer, with the marketplace, is an interesting interaction in order to find kind of the best path to market as to whom might most readily adapt this new innovation. That's the process that we go through here, is taking these things out of the lab, if you will, and then crashing them up against the marketplace to try to see what the best path to that market might be.
What are the sticking points in that process?
Basically, our process is very much a process of applying commercial filters to a piece of science or an innovation. Just as the language that surrounds that science may be very foreign to those of us in the business or consumer community, by the same token, I've found out very much so that the language that surrounds business or commercialization is very foreign to scientists as well, So you have to really kind of bring those two worlds together.
So when you have an object, a thing, innovation that you want to bring to the public, and you start to look at who may benefit, who may want to use this product, how do you navigate sort of those generational gaps?
We have to determine with an innovation what is kind of the value proposition of that innovation. In other words, what's the value that that innovation delivers to the world? And then who does it deliver that value to? And there may be different answers to that. So in sorting through those different answers, in other words, there may be slightly different value propositions that any given innovation might deliver and deliver that to different people, we try to find kind of what's the best initial entry point for an innovation in the market. I mean, what is the optimum value proposition and market segment, how do we connect those in the best way to make it easiest for that innovation to enter the market. Then there may be other people, groupings of people or market segments that this innovation might apply to over time.
Has there been anything that's come across your desk and you're like, I don't even know what to do with this?
Yes and no. I get into that with some of these mobile apps and these various IT sort of things. They solve problems that I don't have. And I see those every once in a while. Now, we don't, and that might go back to your question earlier about age groupings and things like that. You know, the fact that I don't have a particular problem might be the fact of, due to the fact the way I use technology, you know, where other people that maybe use it more deeply might have that problem. And we do see things like that occasionally. We had a project in here last year that was two young engineers out of the engineering school that had what's called a static mixer. And this is just a device that mixes liquids up. And they, when they came in here, thought it would be deployed in processed chemical plants, water purification plants and things like that. Well, as we began to work with that, we found out that indeed that technology would be good in those environments, but that those environments were very difficult to introduce a new technology into and very expensive, and it took a long time, and that given their resources, that would not be a good first market for them to introduce this technology into. We found we all use epoxies that we buy at Home Depot or whatever, and these epoxy tubes have these little static mixers in them. Well, we found that their particular static mixer had multiple advantages in that environment. So that's the market that was ultimately picked to introduce this technology into, and they've been funded, and they're getting up and running. They've got distribution into that market, and they're going to do really well because they picked a good market to enter that was easily accessible or more easily accessible than the big process engineering plant market that they first looked at. But that sort of picking the best value proposition, the best market to go to, is a multifaceted sort of decision that that we help with, so that we can hopefully put these technologies into the market or make them companies and give them the best opportunity to succeed.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education into the decorative arts.
Lake Effect Weekend returns with our storytelling series Ex Fabula right after this here on 89.7 WUWM.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And every weekend, we have Ex Fabula Radio here on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter with Leah Delaney, the co-founder of Milwaukee's Ex Fabula. Da, 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 da.
Ding, ding.
And every week, she brings us stories based on a theme. And this week, of course, no exception. And I always kind of throw it to her by saying the theme this week is...
Only in Milwaukee.
Oh, yes.
We're leading up to our next Story Slam, which is going to be on April 12th at 3041 North. And the theme for that night is Only in Milwaukee. So in Ex Fabula form, we gathered a couple stories relating to Milwaukee and people's experiences in this fantastic city. Mm. I'm excited.
This first story we have truly is only in Milwaukee.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. So this one took place at a Secret Fabula event where we went to Bryant's Cocktail Lounge over in the Walker's Point Mitchell Street area. For those who don't know, Bryant's Cocktail Lounge happens to be the oldest cocktail lounge in southeastern Wisconsin, if not all of Wisconsin, as far as I know. So we held an event there, and we had John Dye, who is the proprietor of Bryant's Cocktail Lounge, slap a story down and give us a little history and tell us about his experience in Milwaukee. So let's listen to John Dye's story.
So my name is John Dye. I'm the owner of Bryant's. I have owned Bryant's. My history, I just want to talk a little bit about that. I grew up in Montana, and then I moved to Seattle because everybody who grows up in Montana moves to Seattle. And I went to college there, and I always was trying to find places like this. When I was a kid, I thought all bars were like this. I thought they were loungy. I was really into swing music. This is what I thought every place was. I thought they were everywhere, and I was just missing out. In Seattle, I looked and looked and looked. And, I mean, there are places that were throwback places, but there weren't any places that were genuine. So I went through the regular, like, life type of decisions. I went to college. I decided to try to get my PhD. So that's what brought me to Milwaukee. I started in environment behavior studies at UWM, which is a PhD in architecture. So I got here and got 3 years through my PhD and absolutely hated it. People were all wonderful, but I was like, this is just not for me. But what I did fall in love with was Milwaukee and all the wonderful establishments here. I realized Milwaukee has all of the places that I was looking for in Seattle my whole life. It has the 5 o'clock club, and it has Bryant's and At Random and all these wonderful places, even down to the corner stores, like family-owned establishments that I think everybody who lives here should feel really lucky that you can go to these places. And unfortunately, there are less than there were when I moved here. One of the bars I loved when I first moved here was the Train Car Bar. I don't know if you guys remember that. The Great Northern, it was just a wonderful place. And I feel really sorry for all the kids these days that had never experienced that. So I'm sure that guy is still being a jerk to someone somewhere. So basically, I did not want to buy Bryant's when I first... I was, I believe, the first person to come look at it to buy. And I went through this really, like, soul-searching, and I just was like, you know, I worked in restaurants and bars all through going to school, and I just thought, this isn't something I necessarily want to do with the rest of my life. And so I tried a bunch of different things, and I was out of my PhD at this time, and I was bartending, I was selling real estate, and I was, you know, doing other stuff, and I was just like, okay. And I had plans to leave Milwaukee. I just really wanted to just leave. And I don't know why. I kind of missed home. I wanted to go back to Montana. But there was something that happened. And basically, if you've ever just been sort of really confused in life and you kind of ask for a sign, you're like, I need a sign. Like, what am I going to do with my life? And I got an email about Bryant's, like, moments after. I mean, it was one of the more bizarre things that's ever happened to me. And so I was like, that's it. I got to buy Bryant's. So it's by far the best thing I've ever done for my life. And I realize it's far more than a bar. It is a bar, but I do feel like a curator here. It's like everything about this place, I try to learn as much as I can. I do as much research as I can. Every story somebody tells me, I write down or try to remember. I mean, sometimes I do get a little weird about some broken stuff, and I keep it. Like, my office is just not good because I won't throw anything away because you, like, never know. Someday you might want this broken blender, you know? But I do really feel like a curator, and I feel very lucky, and I feel very attached to Shirley, and I feel very attached to Pat, the last owner. I met him a couple times when I came in here. Much like Kyle, I'd come in here and kind of confused and, well, you know, no possums when I was here, but I did come here on a very bad date. That was the first time I came here. But basically, I just feel like I've gotten to know everybody so much that this place has really become a part of me. And so everything I just take very, like, I just really, this is my passion, this is my life. And I'm really glad everybody's here today because it means a lot to me because this place means so much to me. And if you ever have any questions or anything about the place, because there is so much history here. And if you ever wonder, why is so dark? Why do they not have a cocktail list? Why, you know, who was the first owner? I mean, all of this stuff I generally know where I can find out the answers. So I really like it when people ask me questions about Bryant's. So. Why is it so dark? I don't know. You know, I think Bryant's is, I think it's so dark because it's the cocktail lounge. I mean, it's just similar to At Random how dark that is. And I think it was because it's more about who you're sitting across than who's on the other side of the room. And that's what I figured out is it's a very intimate space and the way the booths are made. And you're just, everybody's facing each other. And there's no TV to look at. You're not supposed to be looking at your cell phone, even though it's okay, we accept it. But you're really supposed to be looking at the person you came with because this is really a part of socialization. I mean, it's really wonderful. I mean, I can't imagine. I actually met a guy named Bryant. And he was like, I was named after this bar. His parents came here on their dates, and this is where they fell in love, and it was such a part of their lives that they named their kid Bryant. And he actually owns a catering company here called Catering by Bryant. And he has a really good sense of humor. He's like, I'm just glad they didn't date at the Tiny Tap. It's really funny. So, but there's so much about this place that once you spend some time here, you will fall in love with this place. And it just becomes a part of you. And you can't help it. It's just, there's so much history in these walls that I guarantee it's like, come here a few times and it'll become part of your life in Milwaukee. So, and I hope, honestly, I hope everybody appreciates Milwaukee and go support the little places that are still around. Some of them are struggling, but they're what separate the city. What Milwaukee has is these really unique businesses that even people from Chicago come up here and they're just like, Milwaukee's so wonderful. So I hope that everybody who grew up here appreciates Milwaukee as much as the people who move here from other places do. So.
And that was John Dye's story, Only in Milwaukee.
And the cool thing about Bryant's, if you've never been there, it is not something that was redone to look like it was built in 1935.
Yes.
It is the real deal. When you walk in that place, it is 70 years ago.
John is a lover of the aesthetic and of history and loves the history of Milwaukee, too. And in fact, he just purchased Jazz Estate not too long ago and spent a long time getting that together and up to code. And it looks absolutely beautiful. And it looks untouched, but it was touched a lot for
touched.
That year. Yeah. So good job, John Dye, keeping our city of Milwaukee looking neat.
And the stories today, Only in Milwaukee, are pointing towards the next Story Slam coming up. And then it's the All-Star Show in May.
Yes, this is our last Story Slam, our April Story Slam, before we hit the stage at Turner Hall Ballroom in May for the All-Stars event. So a little backup on that. We have Story Slams all through the season, once a month, and we capture all of those audience favorites from each of those months, put them on stage at the end of the season at our All-Stars event, and then they tell longer form stories about a completely different theme. I'm going to keep that theme under my hat for a couple days.
Okay.
We will bring it up at a little later day. Keep it a mystery.
That's okay.
Keep people thinking. And
so, story number two for today.
Yes. This one is from Sierra, who told her change of heart story in January of 2017. So this is Sierra's Only Milwaukee story.
So, I'm a 19-year-old spoken word artist, and that's what I'm known pretty well for, like, around the city. That's what I work for. That's what I did when I was in high school. And, you know, I've turned it into a job for myself. And I work for Dasha Kelly, you know. And so, I'm gonna tell the story of my first slam and kind of how I became not defiant about getting on stage. I'm still pretty defiant to get on stage, like actually speak in front of people. I'm still just like, why? But so we have an open mic called Voltage, and you know, it was like every third Friday. And for us in the culture of poets in Milwaukee, it was just like, yeah, that's like the place to be, to see everybody, all of your friends, because your parents don't let you do anything outside of school. So that's pretty much it for your fun for these 3 weeks. So I come to this slam, and you know, I'm just here with my friends. You know, I'm not doing any open mic. I'm not slam. I'm not doing anything. I only slam with my team. I'm not an individual at all. I'm not going to any competition. I can just be with my team and, yep, be cool with my friends over here. And if anyone's ever met Dasha, Dasha just doesn't work that way. Like, if you've known her business and all of it, just none of it works that way. It's kind of just like she asks you, and then you say yes. And the reason you say yes is kind of because, like, she doesn't really ask you. Like, she's just like, you know, running around extra fast and, yeah, I need somebody to slam. You'll slam for me? I know you got two poems. I heard you do two poems before. That's all you need, just two poems. Like, make it sound easy. No, I don't want to slam. Like, there's only 5-6 people here now, so I look around. There's not that many people. I'll slam if she says she needs me to. Like, okay, be nice person. And then we get probably like 10 minutes later, and now there's like 20 people in here. And I'm like, I don't even know what second poem I'm doing. I was gonna try to do it off the dome, and then I saw people here, and I'm just like, no, that's not an option anymore. Looking through my notebook, I really don't wanna let Dasha down. I kinda wanna be an intern when I grow up. I kinda wanna work for her and impress her, so I need to do something. So I get on stage and I do my first poem, and you know, people respond pretty well. You know, I get some eights and some nines. And I'm like, okay, that seems, you know, pretty good for an average poet. That's what I think I am, you know, an average poet. So I try to get to this second poem and I stumble so terribly on this piece, because it wasn't memorized. I don't even know I'm slamming. So I'm out of my notebook, my hands are shaking, my voice is cracking, I'm skipping words and lines in my head. They don't even know what the story is because I messed up that bad. So I just want to get off stage like I'm not even here. Nope, this is your fault, Dasha, because you wanted me to slam and I wasn't prepared. I would have been good if I was prepared. It's not how that went. So I wait for them to show me my scores, and I ended up getting just all 10s. Just 10 straight through for that poem that I thought it was trash. I'm like, why? There's so many other people I saw were better than me. That's fine. So I guess, you know, that really didn't stop me from being defiant was the points like that. It mattered to me, you know, that was cool. But what really mattered to me was that after I finished the slam and everything, I had someone who was in their like 30s come to me and say, you know, I never had the confidence to talk about what you talked about, and I feel the confidence to talk about it now, so I'm gonna talk about it, like, in my 30s and change my life. Okay, so, I mean, I guess I can be a performer and be on stage. It's cool.
And that was Sierra's story about having a little bit of a change of heart before getting up on stage. I can relate to that. I would like to add, she gives a really great shout out to Dasha Kelly. Dasha Kelly happens to be a staple in the fabric of this amazing city. And I got to give props to people in the city who push people into the fire a little bit. Like, come on, just do it. Don't think about it. Just do it. And, you know, I think 95% of us, after we walk out of the fire, we might actually get a little addicted to that heat, you know, and it's good to keep people on their toes and keep pushing. So, you know, hats off to Dasha, too.
We talked about the two events that are coming up, but if there is anyone who needs to know the details, where, when, how, and other things you have going on, they can go to one place and get it.
Yes, and that would be exfabula.org. I do want to mention another event we have coming up. It's the Milwaukee Big Read Storytelling Workshops, and that's going to be on April 13th, 24th, and 29th in English. April 19th is going to be in Spanish, and that'll be a bilingual storytelling event on the theme of courage on May 4th. So for more information about that, you can also go to exfabula.org.
And Exfabula radio shows are all at wuwm.com if you'd like to share them. Leah, thank you as always for coming by and doing this.
Thank you very much.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and be sure to tune in to the weekday version of the show at 10 o'clock in the morning.
It is all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered. It's coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.